And it's Dakota Midday Science Friday. This is Tech Radio. Your regular host, Kent Osborne, is off this week. So you've got me, I'm Keely Boltina. But we do have our typical panel of tech experts with us. We're here at the KCSD studio on the campus of the University of Sioux Falls. They are Joel Brovelite, Mac and Apple expert. Welcome.
Howdy.
Thank you for coming, although you were the last to arrive, I'd like to point out.
Typical.
John T. Meyer, CEO of Lemonly in Sioux Falls. Thanks for coming.
You bet. Happy to be here.
Jeff Litterick, Technology Integration Specialist with the State of South Dakota, joining us from Peer on the phone. Jeff, hi there.
Hello.
And Amos Aesop, Sales Engineer at SDN Communications in Sioux Falls.
Does it work when I wave on radio?
Well, I can see you, but no one else can. Okay. So thanks for saying hi in person.
Too cool for radio.
That's what it is. So we'll go ahead and get started. No need to mince words here. Let's talk first about the Facebook WhatsApp happening. Who wants to take it and just to kind of set the stage? I got a finger pointed at John T. Meyer.
Oh, geez. Okay. Yeah, this is about 9 days ago, I think. So it was shortly after our last show. But yeah, Facebook acquired WhatsApp, which is a mobile application, kind of text messaging mixed with multimedia messaging, kind of communication device, I guess. And it's interesting, coming off the heels of just, we talked about it in the fall when, late fall, when Snapchat apparently declined a $3 billion acquisition offer from Facebook. And people were like, what are they doing? You know, saying no to $3 billion. It was a big hubbubaloo. But, now, just a few months later, WhatsApp, they buy for $19 billion.
Right. This is a huge.
We're talking significantly more. And everyone's wondering why, because, you know, one of the really good analogy I saw is that WhatsApp is kind of like what soccer is in America, meaning like, so, you know, soccer in America is maybe the fourth, maybe fifth most popular sport, but globally it's the number one most, you know, most popular sport. WhatsApp, actually, most of the users are international, outside of America. So it might not, many of you maybe have never heard of it. You know, it's not on your smartphone, but internationally, tons of users. And so they're, it's a clear sign, like, which we already knew, that Facebook is lacking in that more teenage demographic, 25 and under. And also in the mobile space, you know, people are, now we've gone from wanting all of our social life in one area like Facebook to more of this kind of segmented, you know, I can take pictures on Instagram. I can, you know, send text on WhatsApp. I can, you know, do this on Yelp, you know, kind of more the segmented social networks.
So why is this a big deal other than the fact that this is a lot of money?
Well, you know, I mean, I think John's got it right. It's not a big deal in the United States. It really isn't, at least not now. But it's a huge deal internationally. It's got a huge installed customer base in India and Africa, which are two of the biggest markets that Facebook would like to get into that it already hasn't. And one of the big deals is you don't necessarily even have to have a smartphone to use it. You can have just a phone that has, you know, internet capabilities. And for those that don't know, internet access internationally, particularly in third world countries or developing countries like India, most of the time is through a mobile device, through a phone, a smartphone, or a flip phone. So that's your point of access for internet. And a lot of these places, that internet is actually pretty speedy. And a phone service doesn't work like it does in the States, where you might, it might pay $25 a month and you get kind of unlimited local calls from your phone, or you pay a flat fee of $100 and you get unlimited calls to wherever you want in the States with your mobile. It doesn't work that way. You may not even have a phone. They kind of jumped over having a wired phone into a mobile phone, and you pay by the minute or by the text message. And data is not necessarily that way, and it's a lot faster and cheaper to send a text message, because you just pay a one-time fee. I think it's $1 a year for WhatsApp, I believe is what the service is. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's $10. It's something ridiculous. And people use it in the States to communicate overseas because that's just the way you do it. And it has superseded both instant messaging, texting, and email for forms of communication in India and I think in Africa.
I think it's a big deal because it kind of confirms what we thought, that Facebook is a little concerned about their demographics kind of getting older and losing maybe market share. Certainly, they're still the number one social network, but, you know, as all their users are going to grow up, are they going to continue to use Facebook? So that was one thing. And, you know, it's all a territory battle in with these type of things, whether it be Google, Twitter, Facebook. And so they're always trying to, you know, protect their turf and take each other's turf.
You know, and we've talked about many times about how Facebook and the users are waning and how people are moving away from that. And it's just not the cool social app to be on anymore. But they're saying that WhatsApp, as far as their user base, they still have a 70% user rate. So those people that are signed up and have an account are actually using it on a daily basis, whereas some of the other ones, you know, I know I've signed up for a million social networks, sure, that I've logged into once, found it wasn't for me, and I got out of it, where WhatsApp seems to have that continuing daily activity and eyeballs on the application, which Facebook can now say, we have X amount of people who use this on a daily basis.
And we should delineate the difference. While it is sort of a social network, it really is a messaging service.
Communication platform.
It isn't Facebook. They don't really cross paths other than you can send messages on Facebook. The real big deal is it is just way cheaper to send a message using WhatsApp if you're in India than it is to make a phone call, send an email, or do video conferencing.
Yeah, you're not going to join WhatsApp and connect with other people who like technology or other people who like the Minnesota Twins. You know, it's about talking to your friends.
Or your family, yep, which is huge.
Jeff Litterick, care to weigh in on this this huge acquisition for $19 billion that Facebook is taking on WhatsApp Inc.?
Well, it's to be expected, and there'll be more of them. It's like the panelist said, Facebook is worried, and unlike others like MySpace in the past, they're not going to sit on their laurels and just wait for bad things to happen to them. They're actually proactively trying to gain and to maintain their market share. And when you make that many million people viewers of your ads, that, you know, that's a pure revenue stream for them too. So they've missed out on a couple other ones that other companies have bought recently, but they're on a buying streak, and they plan to, if they can, corner the whole social market if they have enough money to do it. So this is only going to get worse price wise as time goes on for some of these smaller vendors.
Yeah, and one thing to note, this isn't what sometimes is called in Silicon Valley or in the tech space an acqui-hire, where they're, you know, buying a company simply for the talent and for the people to bring in and then shut the service down. The plans, as what they've said thus far, is to WhatsApp will remain what it is and continue to run as a company, much like when they acquired Instagram, you know, for $1 billion about a year ago. So as if you are a WhatsApp user, it should be like you know it is.
Well, it sounds like then there are these different facets to it, because the first is that, you know, maybe people are not using social networks the same way they did 5-6 years ago.
Absolutely.
So Facebook as a business is looking at expanding and trying to figure out how to stay solvent in that way. Not necessarily, especially with WhatsApp, you know, create a new social network or squelch any competitors. This is really an expansion of Facebook as a business, not as a social network necessarily.
Yeah, and it's not like they haven't tried themselves first. So they have a couple standalone apps outside of the Facebook app. That they tried one called Poke, which was kind of like a Snapchat ripoff. That didn't really work.
Poke.
They tried one called Messenger, which is, as you know it, like if you're a Facebook user, up in that top corner, the little speech bubble, which is, you know, the Messenger, but it's actually a standalone, just a mobile app, almost like very similar to WhatsApp. And then even just recently, a month ago, they came out with, or beginning of February, not even, one called Paper, which was kind of a more Flipboard style way to view your newsfeed. You know, so they're trying to, but sometimes you can't move fast enough, and someone did it better, and the best way is to spend all that money they're sitting on.
Well, two things about the price tag. $19 billion sounds like a lot of money, but $19 billion would be a bargain if they could add 20% to their user base overnight, which is what they did. There's over 200 billion users on right now, or actually I think it's about 250 on WhatsApp, which is,
I'm sure, some overlap.
About 20%.
They're also probably on
Facebook.
Of
course. And then the other thing is, you spend $19 billion now, or, you know, liquidate your company in 5 years, 10 years, just trying to stay alive. So,
sure,
you know, it's a bargain for them if they really see the future in that area.
Pretty good story. The co-founders, the original founder is from, I believe, Ukraine, immigrated to America. His co-founder met, they were both working at Yahoo. at one time had really hit rock bottom, I think, got laid off and was, you know, in line, you know, collecting food stamps. And so when he signed this acquisition, he and his co-founder and the venture capitalist, who was kind of the lead investor, they went back to that place where he used to stand in line and get food stamps, and they signed the papers there. And so, I mean, this quite a journey. I saw someone say, you know, hey, you thought The Social Network was a good movie, like, wait for the Hollywood script about WhatsApp.
Absolutely.
Back to the kind of the business side of this too is, it wasn't this past Tuesday, but the Tuesday before, Frontline had a really good hour-long article about marketing, social networks marketing to children and teenagers and young adults. And they've actually, these businesses have calculated this monetary value for each subscriber. And I believe right now it's around $9 per subscriber. So you are worth something as a person if you subscribe to the service and are an active user. And that's what Facebook bought, was they bought a lot of users. So they actually grow their entire market cap by that $9 times how many users of the app. So,
well, and it's important to note, I'm not trying to be cynical here, but when I was doing a little bit of research, I looked at a Bloomberg article that says every internet takeover of more than $10 billion has flopped before. So maybe it's new territory business-wise.
We'll
Who
see.
Knows? While we're on the subject of money and the internet, we should talk about the fact that a major Bitcoin organization has had some major troubles. Who is Amos, would you like to take on the Bitcoin exchange?
You know, well, the problem is giving a adequate and thorough definition of what Bitcoin is.
Yes, what
which
is
we've
Bitcoin?
Already we've already tried on.
It's
the show.
Pretty much impossible,
and we have,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's basically a fiat currency that is only valuable if someone who you're willing to give it to is willing to take it in exchange for something else that has some sort of intrinsic value to it.
Which,
it,
by the way, is the definition of all currency, I'm
absolutely,
going to point out,
absolutely.
Including the dollar.
Yes,
did you call it a fiat
absolutely.
Currency?
A fiat currency.
I've heard that. I've heard
this is some
crypto,
highbrow discussion.
Cryptocurrency, but I haven't heard
Oh, that. I haven't heard the cryptocurrency. Okay. Well, the problem is there's a million definitions out there for it. But basically, it is an attempt to create an alternate currency that allows people to exchange goods and services in for this currency, and there in theory is a finite amount of the currency, and therefore that is supposed to keep the value up because it's not like paper money that the government can print. It's not something that can be just manufactured, but there are ways to do what they call mining, although eventually that's supposed to run out as well. It's my understanding, and I don't know how true this is, that the Mt. Gox that actually went out of business was
filed for bankruptcy.
Filed
in Japan.
For bankruptcy, but was actually started as a Magic the Gathering
Magic
online.
The Gathering. Yeah, they, yeah. In fact, I think they still did that, you know, like more or less on the side, and it was a place where you could buy Magic the Gathering cards.
Okay, you were going over my head, so you're bringing it back now.
Yep, Magic you could buy cards, and yes. They would send a physical card to you, and they're like, hey, we do this online stuff. Let's sell these Bitcoins, and then all of a sudden randomly became one of the largest Bitcoin
and that's where that
repositories.
Mt. Gox came from, is MTGOX, is
yep.
Magic the Gathering Online Exchange.
Well,
look at that.
Which is, yeah, which was something new to me. I didn't realize that was the case. But at one point,
he gets his Magic the Gathering cards other places.
Right.
Oh, he does.
He
right.
gets them
right.
locally.
But I do subscribe
Rainbow?
To the
Does Rainbow cards still have
so. They still do.
At one point, a Bitcoin, which I'm holding my hand up here as though I'm holding one, but you can't actually do that.
Right, there's no coin.
Right, there is nothing. was worth $1,000 for one. And so that's since it tumbled and is massively lower. In fact, I don't even know what it is valued at today.
Well, let's explain. There are a couple different traders, almost like different markets of Bitcoin, and Mt. Gox is one. So it doesn't mean that Bitcoin is now gone. It
right.
just means that Mt. Gox has decided that they're bankrupt. Well, not decided.
Oh, remember, Mt. Gox was by far the largest, and
true.
Since all the troubles have gone, Bitcoins, which were over 1,000 at the start of the year, are down into the $450 range. So there was quite a bit of hit. Not only did they go out of business, $463 million worth of Bitcoins at current pricing have kind of disappeared because of that, too.
And so the idea is that there is no central regulatory agency on this, and that there is no way for any one entity to influence or raise or lower artificially the value, and that the free market should dictate what the Bitcoins are worth and therefore what you can purchase with them. The problem is that there's a lot of skepticism. There's a lot of people who are just not interested in using something that isn't tangible, and that leads to a difficulty in getting it to be a legitimate currency. And so I've read a lot of articles that said that just because this particular exchange went away, that doesn't mean Bitcoin's going away. It'll still be around. In fact, it would be really hard to get rid of it. But I think it's going to remain an underground, a less than ready for prime time currency for a long, long time.
And it's just so foreign and so kind of new to people that I think emotions really swing high. So when you talk about the value, you know, like you can invest in a stock like a Coca-Cola, a company that's been around forever, and feel really safe and good about it.
But I did hear that there were Bitcoin ATMs coming to the United States, though, next year, which I thought that might be the step in the right direction to making this a legitimate and usable by the average person kind of commodity.
Well, one thing that a few analysts have said is that the plan is to get Bitcoin maybe housed in the United States and regulated by the government. A lot of people who own Bitcoins don't want it regulated,
sure.
but the kind of people who trade in them really do want them regulated because that will eliminate a lot of the swings. It's important to note that they've lost half their value for a Bitcoin, but that's still doing better than over half of the actual currency in the world right now as far as its value, whether you're in the Ukraine or Somalia or other countries with troubles. Bitcoin is still doing pretty well in comparison to those. Currency, all currency is online in one way or another. It's here to stay. It may not be Bitcoin, but...
One of the things to watch for, though, and this is what brought down the Tokyo exchange here, is there's actually a flaw in the mechanism that was allowing people to steal Bitcoins from the exchanges. And the rumors are that many of the exchanges have been hit. A lot of Bitcoins have gone missing. No one knows for sure what. So we'll have to wait and see how this goes out. That $483 million were Bitcoins that were stolen through the way the exchanges work and the way the transfer of Bitcoins happen. Hackers found a way to kind of intercept and unauthorize, basically remove Bitcoins from the account. So if that's happened across the board, it's going to be bad news. If it was an isolated incident, it'll probably recover, though it'll take some time.
Well, and it'll take some time public perception-wise. I mean, I admit that I'm not fluent in the language of Bitcoin, and when I see something like an amount worth $477 million belonging to customers is just gone, it's not something I'm likely to invest in. Thanks for the discussion, guys. It's about time for a break, so let's go ahead and take a short break. You're listening to Tech Radio on SDPB, and we have Joel Brovelite, John T. Meyer, Jeff Litterick, and Amos Aesop weighing in on the latest tech news from here in South Dakota and around the world. And we'll be right back. I'm Keely Boltina. Welcome back to Dakota Midday Science Friday. You're listening to Tech Radio. Your typical host, Kent Osborne, is off this week. So I'm Keely Boltina. We have our panel of tech experts. Let's run down the line just because I know I forget to say your names a lot. So people should know who you are. So if they have complaints, they can go straight to you. We have John T. Meyer.
If you offend anybody.
Right. He's CEO of Lemonly in Sioux Falls. Jeff Litterick's on the phone from Peer. He's the technology integration specialist with the state of South Dakota. Amos Aesop is here in studio at KCSD in Sioux Falls, sales engineer at SDN Communications. And Joel Brovelite is our Mac and Apple expert on the panel. So let's talk about this new camera that has come out that is a wearable camera that you clip to you. You have no control over what it takes because it's just taking pictures from your perspective, and it does it twice a minute. Somebody launch this. Joel?
Yes. You actually have the choice. You can have it do once a minute or once every 30 seconds.
Okay.
And you do have control in that you know it happens once every 30 seconds, and you can pick it up and point it at something should you need to. For instance, if you want to take a quick shot of, say, an eagle that flies onto 21st Street in the middle of town, you might want to take your camera out and shoot a couple shots of that. But the brilliant part is that you don't have to do anything to it. You don't even notice it's there. And of course, it sounds absolutely creepy, but if you can imagine going to the park with your kids and having a photojournalist hang around with you and just shoot all the time, so you get these great shots or maybe terrible shots, but you never had to take a picture, and you actually got to experience going to the park with your kid rather than sitting, oh, I need to get my camera. Go do something fun while I am just a photojournalist and I don't even pay attention to you. I think this is where photography is going, frankly. And right now this is cutting edge and early adopter stuff. But in a few years, this is just going to be what you're going to do.
You don't have one, right? Not yet.
Soon.
I figured. It looks
like they're not available yet.
Oh, okay.
5 to 6 weeks.
Okay. Yeah. So it appears on the website here. This is new to me today, just now, during the commercial break.
Right.
That there's an app, and you can upload them onto your app. So I'm curious, where do these photos live? Like, if there's one, I'm like, ooh, that one's kind of a weird
one. Okay, here's the deal. And I mentioned this to my wife as soon as I heard about it. I said, you know, the best part is it's a really stupid, easy 10-year-old piece of technology. It's a 5-megapixel camera. And of course, it's very small, and it will shoot an entire day. It actually lasts a couple of days on battery, and you can upload it to your computer or your tablet or laptop. And in software, it goes through and eliminates the photos that it thinks are worthless, like your arm was in the way, it's too dark, it was blurry. It figures that out in software, and then kicks out. Of course, all those are still there, but it kicks out the ones that it thinks you might want to see. And of course, in other versions of software, as it gets out, it'll use face recognition. So you can just say, well, type in all the pictures of my daughter.
Sure.
And it'll bring up 35 pictures of your daughter. And you'll say, click, 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 click. I want to save those. Bam. The rest you can either save to local or to
download,
a cloud
delete,
device. In
archive.
Fact, I think it comes with several gigs of online storage. And you can do this very easily through both your laptop or tablet device. Or
it appears Amos is buying one right now as I look over at his computer.
So I thought it was silly at first, but then I got to thinking, this is one of those things that I would put on if I'm on vacation, if I'm traveling someplace unfamiliar, and I would put it on and I would forget about it, and it would just randomly take pictures throughout the day wherever
I'm at. So you don't have to.
Right. So I don't have to be conscious of, oh, I got to get a picture of this, I got to get a picture of that. And I honestly can see myself looking at it and saying, going back through the photos and be like, oh, I got a picture of that, and just
wow.
So, yeah. Curious,
ate at this restaurant, and oh, I do have a picture of it. I forgot about that. Yeah, I mean, I thought very much the same thing. Like, I don't want pictures of all my entire day, you know, when I'm sitting typing or I'm working. But if I go to the park or if I go on a vacation or if I go out or something, I definitely want pictures of that. And I hate even taking out my phone to do that. I'd rather just have pictures.
The hardware looks nice. It looks like if you're listening at home and you're on a tablet or computer, getnarrative.com. It looks very similar to like the new Square, the Square mm-hmm. device. And I say new one because there's actually a new version, a little wider, thinner.
Right. But, it's not secretive. It's,
no,
it's designed
the guy's
specifically,
wearing it on his
right.
shirt collar, which to me, I'm curious. Where, like, what's the perspective of my can't? Like, I'm just gonna get, if I'm talking to you, just like your chest and my chest.
A lot of people will probably say, well, I want to put it here, I want to put it there. It makes it very easy. The designer actually said, specifically, he wanted to make sure that it was a device that people knew that it was a camera. So that's why it looks the way it looks. I mean, it's very obvious that it's a camera. It has a lens like a camera phone. It's comes in three colors, but it's very obvious that
you're
wearing such a
thing. It
says
it can store a capacity of 4,000 pictures and battery life up to 2 days. It weighs 7.7 ounces.
And I'm curious if it self-orients the picture. So if he's wearing it on his collar like that, which was kind of crooked, about a 45
That's
degree
the count. I'm thinking you're going to get pictures of the floor, people's shoes.
Yeah, through software.
Not necessarily that, but I mean, when you look at the picture, is it going to be twisted? Is it going to...
I think the software does do that. You know, and of course, that's the beautiful part is that it's software. It's this hardware device. We've talked about this for a year now. It's a hardware device that really does all of the heavy lifting in software. So, you know, they make this product better through software releases. They don't even have, you don't have to buy a new one every time unless you want, you know, more storage or this, that, or the other thing. It can just be better through software, much like the other devices we've talked about.
If anybody has read the book The Circle by Dave Eggers, came out last year, it's a really interesting kind of satire book about kind of Silicon Valley, a little bit on Google and these massive tech companies that want to document all the world's information, whether you, however you feel about privacy, all that thing. They have a product that they release in that book, a little orb, like a little camera that you can just basically attach anywhere in the world. And so, like, if somebody in Egypt put a little camera by the pyramids, I could log in onto the circle and look at the pyramids right now as if I were there. And so the idea is kind of like, if there are eyes everywhere in the world, we're all going to behave you know, more properly, and it'll be a better place and a more peaceful place, and people who are commit crimes will be, you know, documented. And this is a fiction book, obviously, but
not really.
That's however you feel about
Absolutely.
It. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, for $250, you know, I can see all sorts of commercial and hobbyist activities. You could do this. You know, it's cheaper than a security cam, but it takes one every 30 seconds. You know, and it's wireless, runs on battery. You could just drop that anywhere for instant surveillance.
I do think it's cool compared to, like, if you think of, like, GoPro. You know, I was watching the Olympics, and obviously no one competed mid-competition with the GoPro, but some of the snowboarders or skiers would wear it kind of in their warm-ups, and they'd show it on NBC coverage. And, you know, that GoPro is awesome, and that's an incredibly successful company, but this is even smaller and even less obtrusive.
Do yeah. I really have to be the resident skeptic here? Because I've got yes. Joel and Amos. You're in the middle. John T. Meyer's in the middle. I've got Joel and Amos who are gung-ho here.
Amos is buying it right now.
Amos has his wallet out. I'm
watching shipping to
it
him
happen.
Right now as we speak. 5 to 6 weeks.
Maybe I can find someone on my side. Jeff Litterick, what do you think about this narrative clip, this wearable camera? I mean, does this present some challenges as far as security or maybe when it would be appropriate to wear this? Yes, it's the size of a postage stamp, and it's relatively obvious, but that doesn't mean that it couldn't be abused.
Sure.
It will be.
And it will be probably the biggest danger, because you're wearing it yourself, is those embarrassing pictures showing up on Facebook later on when you were drunk that night and didn't remember exactly what you're posting.
He went there.
You know, it's kind of one of those things.
That's true.
Because the GoPro cameras are so popular and stuff, especially with sports and activities and stuff. It's, you know, it's just the next step. It's not as big as a GoPro program. It doesn't do the quality either, but, you know, it's a daily recording of your life. I wouldn't do it myself, but there is a market out there for it, and it will be abused, and it will happen at some private party or some private thing, blow up, but that's the way of that can happen with anything, be it Google Glasses or whatever. There's lots of news stories recently about people pushing back against Google Glasses because they don't understand how it works. People being, you know, even accosted for wearing them, like in bars and stuff. So, you know, it's like any new technology. It takes some time to get over and all the issues worked out with.
I thought the same thing. I was a Google Glass Explorer and got one back in July, which we've talked about on the show, but have not worn it much, especially lately. What you just described, Jeff, happened to me. You know, I got in San Francisco at a restaurant. I got some strange looks, a middle finger. Well, you know, that was like brand new when Google Glass had just come out. And certainly, if you want to, like your example, taking pictures on your vacation, this is much less obtrusive. And something, and I'm not comparing, they're not the same product. Google Glass does more, but interesting.
It may be less intrusive, but it's also more out of your control. And I'm not saying that you don't have control over the product, but you don't have the control over creating the product. So
sure.
When I'm at a press conference for a story and I'm taking pictures of things, I know what those pictures look like. I can frame it specifically. I can make sure that things are in focus. This is not a device that is even intended to do that sort of photography. So I'm not sure it can replace some of the things.
Well, you'd be surprised what software can do for bringing a image in focus or
okay.
even doing it after the photo is taken for, you know, a lot of the stuff that you're talking about for analog photography has been or will be fixed in software, you know, right now, a year ago, a year from now. So the pictures are just going to get better and better. It won't be long where it's not pictures. It's just going to be a steady stream of video that you're just going to take stills from. And people can be scared of this all they want, but this is just the way it's going to be.
One thing I think it does reflect is, and I like the name narrative, talking about the storytelling aspect, kind of. We as society have changed the way we expect photography to be done. You know, it went from the cost of being a professional photographer now is a nice, decent camera and Photoshop. Now, thanks to Instagram and Snapchat and our phones, the selfies, like the production value of what we expect on photos is much lower. You know, we're used to just kind of, that's a smartphone picture. And obviously these devices, the cameras are getting better and better. But I think it kind of reflects that too. I don't know if 5 years ago, whether technology even existed, if people would want this, because they're thinking, well, those are bad photos, or that one's of the floor, or that one.
Well, certainly there were 5-megapixel cameras 5 years ago.
Sure.
But the big deal is, through software and definitely hardware, image stabilization is so much better, color matching, contrast, if it's light or dark, all of that is better. And really, it's not, when we're talking about cameras, if we just move to that slightly, megapixel rating is such a unilateral view of how photography works now. There's so much more that can be done, mostly with software.
Well, I'm saying, I don't think it's a hardware thing. I think it's more of the way people want to capture their lives.
Sure.
Or don't want to capture their lives, because there's nothing that says that people won't be unnerved by this, even if they learn more about it. It doesn't mean that somebody is going to think, well, this is a great idea, or that I'm going to feel comfortable if, you know, Amos brings it in next time on Tech Radio when I'm in, and I'm going, okay, I know what that is. I know it takes pictures in these intervals. That might make other people uncomfortable. So there's a social aspect to this that's going to have to be overcome if this is going to really be mainstream.
Well, and how soon does the narrative too, you know, do video? Does it go from pictures to video?
Absolutely.
And probably on command at some point. You're probably able to...
Yeah, you just hit a button or automatic. Like I said, in a couple of years, it just won't be stills. It will just be video that you'll take streams from. You know, you say Amos would be sitting in here, but you've got 3 devices pointed at you right now that have cameras on them that could be taking photos and aren't. It's just something that's in the wallpaper now. You don't even notice. There are like 10 cameras in this room. And it just happens. That's not going to be any different. I think people are just going to get used to having them around.
To clarify, we're sitting in a circle. We have 2 computers and an iPad.
Right, right. And that doesn't...
We're not shooting. We're not pointing at
3 phones. And
mine's over in the corner. Yeah, you're right. They're everywhere. But, I mean, I'm one of those people that it makes me feel a little 1984 when you start talking about
Absolutely.
That. But you're right. It exists. It's there. And there's nothing that says that those cameras aren't taking pictures. But they're not built to do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And in that interval, when John T. Myers...
They would absolutely be built to do that if they were able to be built to do
that.
Because that's what people want. The instance that I said, you go to the park and you don't have to take photos. Somebody takes them for you. I would have bought a phone 5 years ago that did that. But they weren't available. I think most people in that situation would. Yeah, somebody will take pictures for me. Sign me up.
Right, because then you don't have to break down whatever you're doing to take that photo.
You can actually interact. Mm-hmm. You can actually enjoy the moment, which has always been my problem with photos, especially, you know, personal stuff with family. I hate taking photos because then I'm there, but I'm not participating, and I dislike that aspect of it. So,
well,
not for everybody, as we mentioned.
In 5 to 6 weeks, we'll test it with Amos.
I was going to ask.
Well, you know, actually, it's funny because the shipping was less when I ordered mine.
Oh, you did order one?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, it was $279 was the base price.
$279, yeah. Okay, $239. That's what I told my wife, so she's listening. It's $40 more than I said it was.
Oh,
but you'll have $40 of memories, right?
That's right. Well, I think it'll pay for itself. It's cheaper than a phone. It'll pay for itself.
Well, you can't make calls on it.
Yeah, it's not a phone.
So I'm not going to hate on your enthusiasm. I appreciate the energy. That's good. I'm just
saying. The discussion
saying,
is good.
Jeff has talked about some challenges. I tend to agree with some of those situations, but I could be completely wrong, too, and it might be a big hit and everybody will love it. Who knows? That was a good discussion, guys. Should we take a quick break one more time, and then we'll get back into the fact that the web is officially 25 years old, which makes me feel really old. We have our panel of tech experts here because you're listening to Tech Radio on Dakota Midday Science Friday. I'm Keely Boltina. We'll be right back. It's Tech Radio here on South Dakota Public Broadcasting Science Friday. We have a panel of experts here. And you know the discussion in the last segment was good when the discussion continues throughout the break instead of anybody saying, oh my gosh, that took forever. So we are in the home stretch now for our last segment. We have Joel Brovelite, Jeff Litterick, John T. Meyer, and Amos Aesop here talking about different aspects of technology. And where we're going right now is to talk about the fact that the World Wide Web turns 25 this year. What, March 12th, something like that? I believe
it's
coming up. Mm-hmm. And so I was just reading today on the PBS site that in 1995, 14% of American adults used the internet, and today it's at 87%. So it's really infiltrated and changed the last 25 years. Who wants to launch this one? They pointed at each other. John T. Meyer and Joel Broveleit are trying to get out of it.
That means Amos has to.
Well, I think we got to give credit. Isn't it often, you know, it's not Al Gore. Isn't it usually Tim Berners-Lee who gets credit for being kind of the godfather of the internet or the inventor of the World Wide Web? So, yeah, I'm just pulling up an article here. It says, he made a proposal for the information management system in March of 1989. I was four. Actually, I was three.
It's actually Sir.
Okay, Sir Tim Berners-Lee.
He's a knight now.
He is, he's British.
Yeah, yeah, and if anybody deserved knighthood, I suppose the guy that put up the first web page probably is.
Would you say 87% of the world?
87% of adults.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Adults,
but can I just note you just looked something up on the internet as part of this conversation about the internet. And I just, it's so part of our daily lives now. And I don't know, I don't remember life without it.
Go even further. I pulled up Wikipedia as the first article, which, you know, some people don't like. I think it's great. The crowdsourced encyclopedia. Anyway, that's...
Yeah, so the big deal with the web turning 25 is, I don't think, I know you couldn't name, a piece of technology or a concept that has entrenched so directly in not just American life, but human life so quickly and so ubiquitously. You won't find anything, whether that's telecommunications, TV, radio, power, fire. None of it has entrenched itself that quickly, that quickly and that ubiquitously. So it's a huge deal. I think most Americans, apparently 87%, probably use it every day and use it for work and it's the number one hobby for people. More time is spent on the web than watching TV, than playing with your kids, than, you know, starting fires or watching TV, listening to the radio.
I think the interesting thing is thinking about how fast it, I guess that's what you said, but ubiquitous, but just like expected and commonplace. So I remember, I'm 28 years old. I remember being in middle school and logging into like Alta Vista, you know, and very, very slowly pulling up those web pages. Or when we first had internet at home, you know, dial up. And my brother got in trouble because it was, we were somehow like when he would log into, you know, AOL online, it was pinging like a phone bill to California. So we got the first phone bill that month and it was like $1,000, you know, so we had to like decide how we were going to use the internet at home, has some new rules. But, you know, now, and anyone, I'm trying to guess, if you are 18 and under, 20 and under, you don't know life before.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, my daughter will be driving in the car and she'll have the iPad and she'll have the one that without cellular in it. She'll have her iPad and she'll be like, Dad, I can't get this. I was like, because there's no internet in the car. I don't know what you mean. What do you mean there's no, it's somewhere you can't, no concept. And she's seven. You know, one thing,
it's like, to her, it's like just air. Like,
yeah,
it just,
right.
Like, you know,
this is like, I don't even understand
like
what internet is. You know, and it's funny to talk about something that we've talked about the last two shows, whether for net neutrality related to this. You know, 87% of Americans use the web. I don't think 87% of Americans use the telephone, I would bet, a regular phone.
No.
Yet the telephone is a common carrier. It is important enough to be protected by the FCC. I don't understand how internet is not a common carrier, web access. So it's interesting that this should come up today while all that discussion is going on. So absolutely, it's a huge deal.
Jeff Litterick, you are a technology integration specialist with the state. So the internet makes your job vastly different than even a couple of years ago, let alone what it would have been 25 years ago.
Yes. Because I actually manage the internet and stuff for the state, it's kind of my primary job duty to keep it up and running. for
and when
everyone.
The internet's the down, entire nobody's internet. Happy. Right.
He
nobody's
handles
happy.
The entire Thanks, internet.
Well,
oh, Jeff.
From, and what I was getting to is from a very unique perspective, because I'm down in the plumbing of it, and looking how fragile it actually is, and some of the Comcast stuff that's going on where they're forcing Netflix to pay. We're kind of at a crux. If the FCC does not do net neutrality, the internet you know tomorrow may not be anything like you know the internet today. Not only at you know an application level, but at a plumbing level, where you can access, who you can get to from where, and how good the service truly is. This is going to be an interesting time. Verizon, Comcast, Netflix are just the tipping point because Netflix is the biggest traffic provider on the internet and the new demands they're trying to make. So the internet is a wonderful tool and stuff, but don't take it for granted. It could disappear if we let it disappear, i.e. the major, you know, backbone providers and carriers kind of become the monopoly once again. What you had with the telephone service and back, and most people don't remember, before the 70s, where you could only buy phones from AT&T. You hook up another phone, they'd come and arrest you from another manufacturer, where you had to pay exorbitant long distance. That could return one day. The telephone networks way back when they were first established were much like the internet is today, and yet they turn into one big giant monopoly regulated. So the next 10 years are going to be very interesting.
And the technical side of that you've just touched on is very different from, you know, my perspective being a user not working in the infrastructure of the internet. When I think of the internet, I just want it to work. I don't think about all of these other things.
And most people view the internet as, you know, everything, right? They even kind of mention the whole internet. Well, the internet really is just a collection of very small networks connected together. And anything that disrupts those connections or forces people not to connect basically segments the internet. And actually, in the state, we run a couple of different internets. We have Internet 2 access and Internet 1, which we call commercial, which most people are familiar with. But we also connect to other research networks and stuff we manage. And those are private networks, kind of like the internet, except very closed communities. The internet itself can become that way. Especially if there's only a few backbone providers, because it really is a collection of networks. It's not a monolithic thing that is top-down managed. It's every company that offers it or supports it or connects you to it is connected to other companies, and it's those agreements between all these companies that make it work.
Yeah, and I don't think, you know, to scare that the people that the internet will go away, but it's more – Jeff's exactly right when we talk about net neutrality – we're pretty lucky, but what we have to pay for it, you know, maybe it'll be there, but will it cost an arm and a leg? Yeah, I don't know. But it's an interesting topic, and I think we should, you know, get a birthday cake next month for the internet.
I like that idea. Can we, but as we're talking about net neutrality, I know we've touched on it a couple of times, but let's just rehash exactly what it is. It's this concept that, Joel.
I was actually going to just correct you. It's not necessarily it's a birthday for the World Wide Web. Not
sure.
The internet, which
okay.
was invented much earlier
yeah,
than
good
that.
Point.
So important. The web page thing that we're talking about, that's what was 25 years ago.
You're right.
Going to a web page. So
internet would be 50s?
Yeah, I think.
No, it was in the early 70s, really, when the first nodes came up online and were active. But the ideas were from the 50s and early 60s.
All right. So World Wide Web.
One thing to remember, the very first web page and browser were text only. They had no concept back then of pictures, media, video, sound. It was a text-only experience. So the very first web page and browser just supported basically text, up and down arrow keys, and shortcut keys on the keyboard to move around. So we've come a long way since then.
Interesting to note, the very first web page that was put up,
yeah, what was it?
25 years ago, is lost. Nobody has a copy of it. Or a picture of it, so they're scouring the internet looking for people with photos or anything as of yet. Research, early 60s it looks like is when the internet was developed. So
if you ever want a cool experience, you can go to archive.org.
Yes,
and go back to see old versions of like that.
I love that.
Take copies of what websites looked like in 2006 and 2001 and. It's pretty cool to go back to see, like, you know, the original Google or the original Facebook.
Yeah, they're also cheesy.
Oh yeah,
they're horrible.
I mean, we're talking about Jeff said, you know, the first page didn't have any concept of pictures, and even just how design has changed user experience.
And the internet, originally being meant to disseminate information, was never meant to be a design medium. It was never, HTML, you can't do much with design. That's where the flashes of the world and the shockwaves, that sort of stuff came up. And now HTML5, facilitates that design. But until then, we had these ugly Alta Vista pages. We had these ugly Yahoo pages that were very blocky and very, we could create a table and we could make it as wide or as tall as we wanted.
Well, and that was new stuff.
Yeah.
For absolutely. A while it was just text. What could you do with text?
Yeah.
I will GeoCities. Add this, because this is for those people out there that may be very interested in this, not so much the web, but the first email systems, the first internet, how it all became, how TCP/IP was invented, because the internet wasn't actually first built on TCP/IP, which is the whole underlying mechanism it is today. But there's a book out there called Where Wizards Stay Up Late, The Origins of the Internet. And it details the personal story of the people who created the first nodes, hooked them up, and developed everything that we now use today and take for granted.
And if you're interested in that book, you already have it, so you should finish reading it. So, I'm sorry. I was just thinking that that's not a book I would want to give to my mother. I think that would be a very difficult book to digest.
Well, and it definitely sounds like it would be something very specific to.
Yes.
But there are other... there are other people, I think we've talked about a lot of the different options or a lot of the things that as people start to remember back and think about the interface that they did use, it wasn't flashy, it wasn't pretty. That wasn't its intention, though. And so not only has just the technology shifted, but the reasons we use it, the ways we're implementing it, the expectations we have are very different now than when all of this started, decades or 25 years ago with the World Wide Web, not the internet, the World Wide Web. Right, Joel?
That's correct.
Perfect. Excellent. We have a minute. Anything else that anybody needs to say that's pressing that you have to get out of your system, folks?
Well, I'm hoping that March will come in like a lamb, but it looks like it's going to come in like a lion tomorrow.
Right.
That is not tech related, but I'm just ready for...
at least not.
Spring training baseball is here, and I'm just ready for spring to come.
All right. Well, that's fair.
I see we got a message on Facebook from last time we had a show. Windows XP, it is ending support from Microsoft. That doesn't mean you can't continue to use it. It just means that you can't call Microsoft to get support for it. So don't throw that machine out just because Microsoft stopped supporting it. If you do need to go to something new, go to Windows 7.
That's important to note. Thank you, Amos Aesop. We appreciate it. Joel Brovelite, John T. Meyer, and Jeff Litterick make up our panel of tech experts here on Tech Radio. That does it for this edition of Science Friday Dakota Midday. Thanks also to Steve Zwemke, in addition to the rest of our panelists. And in for Kent Osborne, I'm Keely Boltina. Enjoy your weekend.